Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
Hi, this is Daphne Burt, and I am reading for you today the Cape Cod Times for Thursday, May the 20th. And we begin with the weather. Today, high of 62, breezy in the morning, otherwise sunshine. Tonight, 47 and clear. Friday, mostly sunny, high of 63, low of 50. Saturday, high of 70, low of 52, comfortable with plenty of sunshine. Sunday, high of 69, low of 55, again, plenty of sunshine. Monday, high of 73, low of 54, pleasant with plenty of sunshine. So it sounds like it's going to be a lovely Memorial Day weekend here on the Cape. And now for our lottery results. For the numbers game, Wednesday, May 24th, midday drawing, 5330. Again, that's 5330. And the numbers game evening drawing for Wednesday, May the 24th, is 7563. Again, the evening drawing, 7563. For mass cash for Wednesday, May the 24th, the numbers are 5, 11, 20, 24, 35. Again, mass cash for Wednesday, 5, 11, 20, 24, 35. For the Powerball from Wednesday the 24th, 12, 21, 44, 50, 58 with the Powerball of 26. Again, Powerball for Wednesday, 12, 21, 44, 50, 58 with the Powerball of 26. For the Mega Millions drawn on Tuesday, May the 23rd, the numbers are 3, 10, 22, 65, 66, with the Mega Ball of 19. And again, for Mega Millions, for Tuesday, 3, 10, 22, 65, 66, with the Mega Ball of 19. For the Mega Bucks Doubler, for Wednesday, the 24th, the numbers are 7, 9, 20, 32, 36, 43, and the doubler is 7. Again, for Megabucks Doubler, Wednesday, May 24th, 7, 9, 20, 32, 36, 43, with 7 as the doubler. And finally, for Lucky for Life, for Wednesday, May the 24th, the numbers are 1, 25, 26, 46, 47, with the lucky ball of 18. Again, Lucky for Life for Wednesday, 1, 25, 26, 46, 47, with the lucky ball of 18. And now for the news from the front page. There is a picture here of cars and trucks coming over the Bourne Bridge. And the title of the article is All Hands on Deck Funding Approach. And this is reported by Zane Razak, Cape Cod Times. Massachusetts Democrats are trying a new avenue in the quest for money to rebuild the two 88-year-old bridges that cross the Cape Cod Canal. Noting the Sagamore and Bourne bridges are the only way to get to and from Joint Base Cape Cod by land, U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren and U.S. Senator Edward Markey, alongside U.S. Representative William Keating and U.S. Representative Seth Moulton, have called on Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin to supply some of the $4 billion needed to replace the bridges in a letter dated on Tuesday. Quote, ensuring the Cape Cod Canal bridges are replaced is powerfully important not only for our community, but also to protect our national security, said Warren in a statement to the Times. Quote, this project will require an all-hands-on-deck funding approach from the federal government, and Secretary Austin should exercise his authority to support replacing these bridges, close quote. Built in 1933, the structures have been found to be functionally obsolete and must be replaced. The Fiscal 2021 National Defense Authorization Act gives Austin the authority to support infrastructure projects if he deems it necessary to the readiness and resiliency of a military facility, providing as much as $100 million in any fiscal year, according to the Tuesday letter. Quote, we're trying to spring that money free, close quote, said Keating in an interview with the Times on Tuesday. Warren sits on the Senate Armed Service Committee, while Keating and Moulton are on the House Armed Service Committees. Joint Base Cape Cod on the Upper Cape is home to five military commands training for missions at home and overseas, conducting airborne search and rescue missions and intelligence command and control, according to its website. Camp Edwards is also located on the base, where the primary mission is to prepare soldiers for combat missions. A report by UMass Amherst Donahue Institute, commissioned by Mass Development and cited in the letter, found the base is responsible for more than 5,000 Massachusetts jobs and generated more than $611.7 million in economic impact as of December 2021. Quote, it's clear that these bridges are essential to preserving Joint Base Cape Cod's mission essential functions, the letter states. The letter cites a U.S. Army, quote, Army installation strategy supporting the Army in multiple domains report that points to the need for resilient systems at Army installations and in surrounding communities. While the bridges were built by and have been owned and maintained by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the effort to replace them is a joint operation between the Army Corps of Engineers and the Massachusetts Department of Transportation. Quote, of the different major projects around the country, it sort of stands alone as by far the most expensive because you have two of them aging at the same time, said Keating. Earlier, the project hit a roadblock when the federal government rejected two bids by the Army Corps of Engineers to secure more than $1 billion. Requests for funding from the U.S. Department of Transportation's Bridge Investment Program and INFRA, officially nationally significant multimodal freight and highway projects, grant money, were both denied. In March, it was announced that President Joe Biden had included an initial $350 million for the replacement of the nearly 90-year-old Sagamore and Bourne bridges in his fiscal 2024 federal budget. That $350 million would be encompassed in an overall commitment of $600 million, along with a legislative proposal to allow the Army Corps of Engineers to transfer those funds and ownership of the bridges to the state, which would be responsible for their future operation and maintenance. Governor Maura Healey's office said it anticipates including approximately $263 million for the Cape Cod Canal Bridges project in fiscal 2024 to 2028 capital investment plan, expected to be finalized later this month or early June. Healey has pledged to double the state's commitment made by the prior administration by allocating up to $700 million for the project in total. And also from the front page, Wellfleet dredge plan would restore 28 acres in Blackfish Creek by Denise Coffey for the Cape Cod Times in Wellfleet. The dredge task force believes it has come up with a plan for the dredging of Area 2, South Mooring, in Wellfleet Harbor that satisfies the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and it would benefit the town, reinvigorate the oyster beds, and would cost significantly less money than the $14 million fee floated previously. Co-chair Christopher Alger gave an overview of the plan details during a community forum on Monday. The dredge area, about 23 acres of the South Mooring Field. The acre was last dredged in 1957, so this is considered improvement rather than maintenance dredging. The town needs a permit because of federal regulations regarding improvement dredging. That permit requires a mitigation plan or a payment of a hefty fee. The original fee of $14 million dropped to $4.5 million following lengthy discussions between the town and the Corps of Engineers, according to Alger. Mitigation plan is an alternative to the fee. This mitigation plan would restore and improve 28 acres in Blackfish Creek by placing culch or sea clam shells for oyster spat and monitoring oyster populations and water quality. A phased implementation of the plan would allow Wellfleet to start by placing culch on 14 acres of the Herring River, for which the plan already has a permit. Benefits of the mitigation plan. The work would create significant new oyster population. The oyster harvest will be larger and become self-sustaining. It will aid the protection of juvenile fish and improve overall fishing in Blackfish Creek. Larger oyster populations will protect the shoreline and reduce energy impacts from storm waves. Water quality will improve, as noted in research done by the Center for Coastal Studies. Their research on black custard showed it was the result of decaying marine vegetation, which leads to lack of oxygen. Dredging of Area 2 will also provide protection to 100 acres of shellfish fish flats in Chipman's Cove. Beneficiaries of the plan? Shellfish harvesters, boaters, and anyone in favor of improved water quality, enhanced habitat, and using state grants for harbor improvement purposes. Results of the dredge. Improved safety in the South Mooring Field because it will allow boats to enter and leave at low tide. With increased accessibility, 80 additional moorings could be added. Dredging will stop the encroachment of black custard, a thick, organic, non-toxic sediment, on shellfish grants in Chipman's Cove. It will preserve the state funds to improve the harbor. Costs. The first year's estimated cost will be $83,000, Algiers said. Third-party monitoring is expected to cost $20,000. An amended Chapter 91 will cost $40,000. The remaining costs will be spread out to cover the costs of culch, seed, and shellfish department costs. Years 2 through 5 will cost an estimated of $30,000, including up to $12,000 for the shellfish department and $20,000 for continued monitoring. After the fifth year, the town's shellfish department will monitor the metrics. Important deadlines. The town must get approval for the plan prior to dredging. The town has already been awarded a $2.5 million state grant for the dredge, but must have a vendor under contract by June the 30th, 2023. Bids for the dredge were due May the 25th. The select board must award the bid, prior to June 30th, according to Alger. Mitigation plan. There will be performance metrics around oyster population, oyster density, biodiversity, and ecosystem uplift, Alger said. An adaptive management plan would be in place to address issues that come up, such as if the oyster population doesn't increase as expected in a certain time frame. Reporting requirements are: annual reporting by a third party is required for the first 5 years. After the town receives a certificate of compliance, the town will self-verify the plan metrics. Continued reporting will cover the future dredging of Area 2 in terms of qualifying for a core permit for dredging. The details of the plan can be found in the Select Board packet for May the 23rd, 2023, pages 66 to 106. From page 2, Cape Cod weather forecast for Memorial Day weekend by Eric Williams for the Cape Cod Times. Here comes one of the busiest weekends on the Cape Cod calendar and the unofficial kickoff to the summer season. Some things are certain. During the Memorial Day weekend, restaurants and shops will be open, backyard grills will be fired up, and we will honor the sacrifice of those who lost their lives in military service. Other components of the big weekend are less predictable. In the traffic department, we can all be thankful that bridge repairs are over, at least for now. But it's fair to assume that there may be congestion and frustration on the roads at times. Perhaps the biggest question of the weekend is, will it be beach weather? After all, we've slogged through winter and a pretty chilly spring, and some of us may have purchased spiffy new bathing suits. The idea of laying on a Cape Cod beach in the warm sun and maybe even taking a dip sure sounds good, and many would argue that we dang well deserve it. With sandy hopes and dreams in the balance, we turn to the folks at the National Weather Service and their forecast for the Memorial Day weekend. Right now, it's looking good, said Alan Dunham, meteorologist at the NWS Boston Norton office. You're looking at dry conditions, partly to mostly sunny skies, and high temperatures in the upper 60s. While the temperatures don't sound tropical, there's a lot to like about the forecast. It will still be sunny and seasonable at the beach, although swimming may only be for the hardy among us. Dunham also cautioned that water temperatures around the Cape are still pretty chilly. The water temperature is currently about 56 degrees in the middle of Cape Cod Bay, according to information from the National Data Buoy Center. Another buoy in the Atlantic Ocean, about 9 nautical miles off of Provincetown, reported water temperature around 51 degrees. Closer to shore, a station near Woods Hole came in with a water temperature around 59 degrees. This made me wonder about the temperature of the Cape's lakes and ponds, so I drove my food thermometer over to Long Pond in Wellfleet and dipped it in the water. The highly unscientific and amateur escapade produced a reading of 69 degrees, so perhaps a dip in smaller body of water might prove less daunting this weekend, and you'll still be able to tell amazed friends that you swam on Cape Cod in May. And here's the Memorial Day weekend weather forecast for Hyannis from the National Weather Service. Thursday, partly sunny with a high near 57, breezy with a north wind 18 to 22 miles per hour. Thursday night, partly cloudy with a low around 46, northeast wind 8 to 14 miles per hour. Friday, mostly sunny with a high near 65, north wind around 10 miles per hour. Friday night, partly cloudy with a low around 50, south wind around 10 miles per hour, becoming northwest after midnight. Saturday, mostly sunny with a high near 69, north wind around 10 miles per hour. Saturday, partly cloudy with a low around 53, south wind around 11 miles per hour, becoming west after midnight. Sunday, mostly sunny with a high near 67, west wind 10 to 13 miles per hour, becoming south in the afternoon. Sunday night, partly cloudy with a low around 54, south wind 10 to 13 miles per hour. And Memorial Day, partly sunny with a high near 68, north wind around 10 miles per hour, becoming east in the afternoon. And in case you're wondering, yes, that means that we did just read the forecast for the weekend twice. The forecast in this particular article was for Hyannis and included the wind speeds. And more local news by Heather McCarran for the Cape Cod Times. Cape's first white shark sighting heralds summer. Summer won't be official for another few weeks, but for the great white sharks that frequent Cape Cod waters during the warmer months, the season is already underway. The first white shark of the year was spotted during a Dolphin Fleet whale watch on May the 20th off of Provincetown, near the southwest border of the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary. The sighting has prompted scientists to remind people to be aware of their surroundings if they venture into the water over the holiday weekend, and to report shark sightings for ongoing research. White sharks spend the summer and into fall hunting seals in inshore waters off of Massachusetts, most notably off Cape Cod's eastern shores from Provincetown to the southern tip of Monomoy, but also within the bay. The first shark of the season may be the Vanguard, but it certainly is not an unexpected guest at the marine dinner table. "It's right on schedule for what we see this time of year," said John Chisholm, adjunct scientist at the New England Aquarium's Anderson Cabot Center for Ocean Life and citizen science coordinator for the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy in Chatham. According to Andrea Spence, a naturalist with the Provincetown-based Dolphin Fleet Whale Watch, the shark was seen feeding on a gray seal only about 100 feet from the boat. "The entire boat was in complete awe of what we were seeing," she said. Quote, "It's sure to leave a lasting impression on passengers and crew alike," she said. "We were very lucky to be in the right place at the right time to capture such an incredible event." Shark sightings during whale watching trips are rare, but not unheard of, Spence said. Quote, "Dolphin fleet boats have sighted white sharks in the past, particularly when there is a whale carcass floating offshore with sharks scavenging it. But it's certainly uncommon, even more uncommon, to witness a complete predation event like we did. We'd like to say that every trip is different and we never know exactly what we'll see. This was proof." Close quote. It was Spence's first time seeing a white shark offshore, she said. She estimated it was about 12 feet in length. Chisholm said Spence and Kathy Bulger, who also works on the Whale Watch, reported the sightings to him, since he documents the accounts of shark-seal interactions and verifies shark sighting reports made by the public through the Sharktivity app. Chisholm helped create Sharktivity and has been its official coordinator since last year when the New England Aquarium and the Atlantic Shark Conservancy partnered around the app. Chisholm said he also keeps track of other species, but Sharktivity documents only white sharks. The app provides information and push notifications on white shark sightings, detections, and movements, quote, "to raise awareness and help people and sharks coexist," close quote, according to the New England Aquarium. Sightings are input into the app by researchers, safety officials, and others who upload photos and video, quote, "essentially crowdsourcing critical data on where sharks are spotted," close quote. In 2022, several dozen white shark sightings were recorded through the app, Chisholm said. The numbers of white sharks present in the waters of Cape Cod, he said, has, quote, "generally increased," close quote, in recent years. That statement is corroborated by shark expert Greg Scommel, a senior biologist with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries, who spends much of his time in the summer studying the Cape's white sharks. "The animals tend to congregate here from May or June through November, peaking from August through October. In recent years, Cape Cod has emerged as one of the world's white shark hotspots, and the shark's only known aggregation site on the Atlantic coast," according to Scommel. "Because of that, it's become a premier place for conducting research and testing new observational, detection, and warning technologies. The sharks have also become a big tourism draw." Although white shark bites on humans are rare, Chisholm and others said the season's first sightings, quote, "serves as a reminder to beachgoers and boaters to be mindful of the presence of these ocean animals. It's important to be aware of sharks' presence in shallow waters to avoid areas where seals are present or schools of fish are visible, and to stay close to shore where rescuers can reach you if needed," he said. "There's a real public concern around beach safety, and we recognize the need to respond to that," said Nick Whitney, senior scientist at the aquarium and chairman of the Anderson Cabot Center's Fisheries Science and Emerging Technologies Program. Aquarium researchers are invested in continuing their partnership with the Conservancy, quote, "to help provide accurate, timely information on shark sightings in the region," Whitney said. White sharks aren't the only sharks in Massachusetts waters. Chisholm said the most abundant sharks here are the Atlantic spiny dogfish. There are also poor beagle sharks, which remain year-round, in addition to Atlantic shortfin makos, blue sharks, sandbar sharks, and tiger sharks, among others. White sharks and makos are the two species that predominantly feed on seals. Quote, "They are the only ones big enough to handle them," Chisholm said, though poor beagle sharks also have the ability to bite seals. It's about the halfway point in our reading today, and so we turn to the obituaries. There are five of them today. From Eastham, John E. Beboot passed away in his home in Eastham, Massachusetts on May the 17th, 2023. He was born in Orange, New Jersey on August the 9th, 1942, to Ann Reed Beboot and John Beboot. He graduated from Rutgers University in 1964 with a degree in English literature and then went on to study law at American University in Washington, D.C. He practiced general and domestic law in New Jersey and Massachusetts until his retirement. As a child, he spent many summers with family in Wellfleet, eventually doing seasonal work and learning to sail. When he moved to Eastham in the 1980s, he bought his own boat and spent many happy hours sailing in Wellfleet Harbor and Cape Cod Bay. He had a lifelong love of literature and read the classics as well as current fiction and biography. He wrote poetry, short stories, and a novel. He enjoyed planting a vegetable garden each year. One spring, as members of the Eastham Forum, he and friend David Hurley designed and planted the large Eastham Forum flower island on Massasoit Road. He also served on the Water Resources Advisory Committee. He enjoyed cooking for friends and family. His roast beef and Yorkshire pudding were legendary. He could reproduce his favorite restaurant dishes with great success, especially the ones from the original Aesop's Tables in Wellfleet, where he was a waiter one summer. He is survived by his brother, Hugh Reed Beboot, and his sisters, Judith Cloud Beboot and Alice Louise Beboot, and a cousin, Joy Harrington. He is also survived by Madeline Vic Anderson and his stepchildren, Adrian Bartlett, Susan Dasty, and Sarah Goulet, five grandchildren and four great-grandchildren. For condolences, please visit www.nickersonoforleans.com. Sorry, that's www, all one word, nickersonoforleans.com. No other arrangements have been printed as yet. Our second obituary is James Henry Jim Cahill, reported from Kootuit. James Henry Cahill, or Jim, as his family and friends called him, of Kootuit, died May the 21st, 2023, at Cape Cod Hospital. He was 88 years old. Born in 1934 to James Cahill and Jenny Porter, Jim grew up in East Providence and attended the University of Rhode Island. After graduating, he served in the Army, during which he received commendations by his supervisors for leadership. In 1958, he met his wife Sally, née Peckham, at a wedding party. The two married in 1960 and raised their children, Beth, James, and Jane, in Seekonk, Massachusetts. Jim and Sally shared an extraordinary special love for one another during all 63 years of their marriage. Jim spent most of his career as a wheelchair salesman, working for Everest and Jennings, and after living in California for years post-retirement, in 1996, Jim and Sally moved to Kootuit. Here, Jim was an active member of the community. He belonged to the Osterville's Men's Club and was a skilled player for their bowling league. He also played golf for over 20 years after his retirement. One of his greatest passions was history. In addition to being an avid member of the Cape's Civil War Roundtable, he extensively researched his own family history, compiling heirlooms, family trees, letters, and stories to create a comprehensive lineage. Most people, though, will remember Jim for his kindness, generosity, and humor. He freely shared his many wild stories and could make anyone laugh with his dry wit. He extended his understanding and a listening ear to anyone who needed it. It is impossible to convey in a short obituary how extraordinarily special he was. Jim is survived by his loving wife, his children, 8 grandchildren, great-grandson, and countless others touched by his life and presence. Calling hours will be from 4 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m. on Tuesday, May the 30th, at Chapman Funerals and Cremations, 74 Algonquin Avenue, Route 151, in Mashpee. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to the Wounded Warrior Project at Post Office Box 758516, Topeka, Kansas, 66675-8516, or online at www.woundedwarriorproject.org. For online guestbook and directions, please visit www.chapmanfuneral.com. This obituary is for Faith Clark, and it is reported from Concord, New Hampshire. Faith Clark, 95, passed away on May the 2nd, 2023, in Concord, New Hampshire. She was born on November 28, 1927, in Hanover, New Hampshire, the second child of the Reverend Alan W. Clark and Doris Badger Clark. She is survived by her younger brother, Richard C. B. Clark of Osterville, Massachusetts, her daughter, Carrie Bell of Abington, Pennsylvania, as well as numerous nieces, nephews, and cousins. She was predeceased by her older brother, Alan W. Clark, Jr. of Waitsville, Vermont. Faith received her Master of Arts degree after attending Boston Conservatory and New York University, and her Ph.D. from Florida State University. Over the years, she attended and sang in choirs of various Episcopal and Methodist churches. She served in a number of positions in the fields of dance and physical education and taught at St. Philip's Community Center, Erica Timey Dance Theater, New York University, Illinois State University, and Western Illinois University. She conducted numerous dance institutes. Her teaching curriculum included basic dance skills, improvisation, choreography and theory, dance notation, and history of dance. She sponsored Orchesis Modern Dance Company and Folk Troupe. After retirement, she spent her time and energy traveling and volunteering. She led 5 National Education Association trips for educators and traveled on her own to 23 countries. Most outstanding for her were the polar bears of Canada and the animal kingdoms and rich scenery of Africa and Patagonia. She was an avid volunteer. She ushered at the 2 Concord, New Hampshire theaters, volunteered for the Pan Mass Challenge, the Highland Games, and the Sandwich Crafts Fair. She had a special interest in sacred dance and created and produced narrative service for the Shaker Museum. She was not one to be idle and enjoyed cooking, photography, working in stained glass, and knitting baby blankets for the Concord, New Hampshire Hospital. She also had many years of active cross-country skiing and snowshoeing. During her recent days, she enjoyed keeping in touch with friends. Special thanks are to be given to the team of Mary Miller, Jillian Grant, and Amanda Harris, who helped her through the tough times. A memorial service will be held at Kimball House, Capital Center for the Arts, 44 South Main Street, Concord, New Hampshire, on Tuesday, June 13th, at 11 a.m. Her ashes will be interred at Wanalancet Cemetery, Tamworth, New Hampshire, later this summer. Contributions in her name may be made to Wanalancet Chapel in care of Henry Steele, 46 Porter Street, Apartment 2, Somerville, Massachusetts, 02143. Our next obituary is for Donald E. Emond, Eastham. Donald E. Emond, 88, passed away peacefully with his son by his side in Lake Placid, Florida, on May the 2nd, 2023. Donald was born in Eastham, Massachusetts, on April the 8th, 1935. Married nearly 60 years to the late Harriet Frances Freeman on September 19, 1963. Donald was a loving and dedicated husband who enjoyed a long retirement with his wife Harriet. Donald had a large personality and will be missed by his extended family, son D. Scott Emond and daughter-in-law Cindy of Xenia, Ohio, son Gary R. Brook and daughter-in-law Valerie of Brewster, Massachusetts, son Craig A. Brook of Franklin, Massachusetts, daughter Darlene Burke of Dennis, Massachusetts, grandchildren David Brook, Justin, Kyle, and Aaron Brook, Ashley Seguencia, and numerous great-grandchildren. Donald was one of eight children and is survived by his sister, Helen Casoli. All are welcome to a graveside service that will be held on Friday, May the 26th, 2023, at 2 p.m. at Evergreen Cemetery, Eastham. For full obituary, please visit www.nickersonfunerals.com. And finally, the obituary for Irene Hurley from Mashpee. Irene Hurley, born November 21, 1931, passed to the next life on May 18, 2023, after a short illness. Born to Irene and Reno Whitman in New York City, she grew up in Queens, New York, with her beloved siblings, Andrew, Ramona, Kate, and Joan, deceased. A lifelong nurse, she completed nursing school at Southampton Hospital, where she started her career. It was at the hospital that she met her husband, Jack, with whom she had a large, boisterous family of six children: John, Judy of Vermont, Mitch, Peugeot of New Hampshire, Kate, John of Massachusetts, Gumbo, Pat of Southampton, Ed of Southampton, and Matt, Asia of Vermont. Irene is also survived by numerous grandchildren and now great-grandchildren. As the demands of her family lessened, Irene took up running and competed in the New York City and Marine Corps marathons. Irene was a voracious reader and a proud member of her book club. After retirement from nursing, Irene enjoyed working with her friends Sheila and Sandy at Second Chance Boutique, selling and advising clients on vintage furnishings and accessories. Cape Cod was the chapter for Irene where she enjoyed the many amenities of Maplewood and Laurentide independent living, where she took part in as many activities, outings, and committees as humanly possible. The family would like to thank the many caregivers of Cape Cod Healthcare and Liberty Commons Rehab, especially Dr. David Rancourt and the staff of the Cardiovascular Associates and Dr. Hank and Lynn Casey. Per Irene's wishes, a small family remembrance is planned in Mashpee. For national news, McCarthy sends in negotiators, not giving up on debt deal, but sides, quote, far apart. Researched and reported by Lisa Mascaro, Stephen Groves, and Sungmin Kim for AP from Washington. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy said Wednesday he was sending Republican negotiators to the White House to finish out debt limit talks, but warned that the two sides are still far apart as they try to reach a budget deal with President Joe Biden. McCarthy said he remained optimistic they could make progress in hopes of an agreement before a deadline as soon as next week, when the Treasury Department would run out of cash to pay its bills. "We're not going to default," said McCarthy, Republican from California. Defiant, the speaker said, quote, "It's not my fault that Washington was careening toward a crisis, pushing blame onto the White House for Biden's refusal to negotiate earlier as Republicans acted to slash spending." Quote, "I'm hoping we can make progress," McCarthy said. "I'm not going to give up." Debt ceiling negotiations are locked on a classic problem that has vexed, divided, and disrupted Washington before. Republicans led by McCarthy want to roll back government spending, while Biden and other Democrats do not. Time is short to strike a deal. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said Wednesday that, quote, "It seems almost certain," close quote, "that the United States would not make it past early June without defaulting. That would be catastrophic, as the government risks running out of cash to pay its bills as soon as June the 1st. We are seeing some stress already in Treasury markets, Yellen said in a Wall Street Journal event. Quote, even as the run-up to an agreement, when one does occurs, there can be substantial financial market distress. We're seeing just the beginnings of it, Yellen said. The political standoff is edging the country closer to a crisis, roiling financial markets and threatening the global economy. Anxious retirees and social service groups are among those making default contingency plans. Negotiators were heading to the White House to resume talks at noon. Cheered on by a hard-charging conservative House majority that hoisted him to power, McCarthy, Republican from California, was not swayed by a White House counteroffer to freeze spending instead. Quote, a freeze is not going to work, McCarthy said. Quote, we have to spend less than we spent last year. That is the starting point, close quote. Failure to raise the national debt's ceiling, now at $31 trillion, would risk a potentially chaotic federal default, almost certain to inflict economic turmoil at home and abroad. Dragging into a third week, the negotiations over raising the nation's debt limit were never supposed to arrive at this point. The White House insisted early on it was unwilling to barter over the need to pay the nation's bills, demanding that Congress simply lift the ceiling as it has done many times before with no strings attached. But the newly elected speaker visited Biden in the Oval Office in February, urging the president to come to the negotiating table on a budget package that would reduce spending and the nation's ballooning deficits in exchange for the vote to allow future debt. I told the president February the 1st, McCarthy recounted. I said, Mr. President, you're not going to raise taxes. You've got to spend less money than was spent this year. Negotiations are focused on finding agreement on a 2024 budget year limit. Republicans have set aside their demand to roll back spending to 2022 levels, but say that next year's government spending must be less than it is now. But the White House instead offered to freeze spending at the current 2023 numbers. By sparing defense and some veterans' accounts from reductions, the Republicans would shift the bulk of spending reductions to other federal programs, an approach that breaks a tradition in Congress of budget cap parity. Agreement on that top-line spending level is vital. It would enable McCarthy to deliver spending restraints for conservatives while not being so severe that it would chase off the Democratic votes that would be needed in the divided Congress to pass any bill. But what, if anything, Democrats would get if they agreed to deeper spending cuts than Biden's team has proposed is uncertain. The White House has continued to argue that deficits can be reduced by ending tax breaks for wealthier households and some corporations. But McCarthy said he told the president at their February meeting that raising revenue from tax hikes is off the table. The negotiators are now also debating the duration of a 1% cap on annual spending growth going forward, with Republicans dropping their demand for a 10-year cap to 6 years, but the White House offering only 1 year for 2025. Typically, the debt ceiling has been lifted for the duration of a budget deal, and in this negotiation, the White House is angling for a 2-year agreement that would push past the presidential elections. Past debt ceiling talks have produced budget agreements in which both parties have won some concessions in a give and take. Republicans, however, are pushing additional priorities as the negotiators focus on the $100 billion-plus difference between the 2022 and the 2023 spending plans as a place to cut. They want to beef up work requirements for government aides to recipients of food stamps, cash assistance, and the Medicaid health care program that the Biden administration said would impact millions of people who depend on assistance. The White House is countered by keeping defense and non-defense spending flat next year, which would save $90 billion on the 2024 budget year and $1 trillion over 10 years. McCarthy promised lawmakers he would abide by the rule to post any bill for 72 hours before voting, making any action doubtful until the weekend. The Senate would also have to pass the package before it could go to Biden's desk to be signed. McCarthy faces a hard right flank in his party that is likely to reject any deal and that has led some Democrats to encourage Biden to resist any compromise with Republicans and simply invoke the 14th Amendment to raise the debt ceiling on his own, an unprecedented action the president has resisted for now. Our next story, reported by Ann DiNocencio for the AP from New York. Target pulls some LGBTQ plus merchandise from stores. Target is removing certain items from its stores and making other changes to its LGBTQ plus merchandise nationwide ahead of Pride Month after an intense backlash from some customers, including violent confrontations with its workers. Since introducing this year's collection, we've experienced threats impacting our team members' sense of safety and well-being while at work, Target said in a statement Tuesday. Quote, given these volatile circumstances, we are making adjustments to our plans, including removing items that have been at the center of the most significant confrontational behavior. Target declined to say which items it was removing, but among the ones that garnered the most attention were tuck-friendly women's swimsuits that allow trans women who have not had gender-affirming operations to conceal their private parts. Designs by Aprellin, a London-based company that designs and sells occult and satanic-themed LGBTQ plus clothing and accessories, have also created backlash. The Pride merchandise has been on sale since early May. Pride Month is held in June. Target confirmed that it has moved its Pride merchandise from the front of the stores to the back in some southern stores after confrontations and backlash from shoppers in those areas. Target's response to confrontation in its stores is taking place as state legislatures introduce a record number of bills targeting LGBTQ plus individuals. There are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills that have gone before state legislatures since the start of this year, an unprecedented number, according to the American Civil Liberties Union. Those efforts focus on health, particularly gender-affirming health care for transgender youth and education. State legislators are pushing to prevent discussions in school regarding sexuality and gender identity. At least 17 states have enacted laws restricting or banning gender-affirming care for transgender minors, though judges have temporarily blocked their enforcement in some, including Arkansas. An Associated Press analysis found that often those bills sprang not from grassroots or constituent demand, but from the pens of a handful of conservative interest groups. Target's Pride Month collection has also been the subject of several misleading videos in recent weeks, with social media users falsely claiming the retailer is selling tuck-friendly swimsuits designed for kids or in kids' sizes. The move comes as beer brand Bud Light is still grappling with a backlash from customers, angered by its attempt to broaden its customer base by partnering with transgender influence Dylan Mulvaney. Bud Light's parent company said it will triple its marketing spending in the U.S. this summer as it tries to restore sales it lost after the brand partnered with the transgender influencer. Target and other retailers, including Walmart and H&M, have been expanding their LGBTQ plus displays to celebrate Pride Month for roughly a decade. This year, transgender issues have been a divisive topic in state legislatures, and the backlash has turned hostile. For sports news, this article is entitled Hazy Future: We Need to Be Okay with This Being the End for LeBron. LeBron James could not beat the Denver Nuggets in the Western Conference Finals, but managed to wrestle away most of the attention from their 4-0 sweep when he suggested that returning for a 21st NBA season was no sure thing. Quote, we'll see what happens going forward. I don't know, he said. I've got a lot to think about, to be honest, And just with me personally going forward with the game of basketball, I've got a lot to think about, close quote. This comment has caught a lot of fans off guard. That's partly because of the assumption that James to continue to defy nature by his sheer will, and partly because he has stated many times that he wants to play alongside his son Bronny before retirement. But it should not surprise anyone that James would seriously consider walking away now, at age 38, in a league where hardly any of his contemporaries are still hanging around. There's no point in making predictions about what James is going to do. It's his life, his career, his body that gets put through the ringer over the grind of an 82-game season. He'll decide whatever he decides on his timetable. If you can't understand why he might have played his last NBA game, however, you're not paying attention. Most of us can know what James's body feels like after 1,700 NBA games of mileage, or exactly what it takes at this stage for him to be ready to go perform the way he did on Monday, when at times he still looked like the best player on the floor. But rest assured, it gets less pleasant every year. There have been numerous stories about James spending $1.5 million annually in an attempt to defy Father Time, encompassing everything from nutrition to massage, from hyperbaric chambers to cryotherapy. The discipline and meticulousness it takes to still be in NBA-level physical condition nearing age 40 is something most of us can't imagine. And still, after all that effort just to stay on the court, James battled nagging injuries this season and was physically spent at the end of some of those games to the point where he looked old and mortal. As James has said repeatedly, he's still willing to do what it takes if he can win championships. But if that window has closed in his mind, after everything he's accomplished in the game, does he really want to put himself through the gauntlet for another year? Let's hope he does. It would be understandable if he doesn't. We see this situation a lot in tennis, where every great player has to decide at some point whether the effort and the constant training are worthwhile if they are no longer viable contenders to win the biggest prizes. There's little doubt that if Serena Williams wanted to come back, she could get herself in playing shape relatively quickly, beat a bunch of players on the WTA tour, and maybe even make a Wimbledon quarterfinal on her experience and talent alone. But when you've won as much as she has, you don't put your body through all of that just to hope for more quarterfinals and semifinals. The price is too high and the return is too low. As James said Monday night, "I don't play for anything besides winning championships at this point in my career. I don't get a kick out of making a conference finals appearance. I've done it a lot, and it's not fun to me, and it's not to be able to be a part of getting to the finals." The good thing about basketball, of course, is that it's not an individual sport. LeBron doesn't have to be peak LeBron for 82 games to meaningfully contribute to a team, and after a few weeks of reflection, he may well want to give it another go. But even James understands at this point he isn't capable of carrying the Lakers to another title. He had some exceptional moments in those playoffs, from the great close in Game 4 against the Grizzlies to the first half on Monday when he scored 31 points. In the second half, though, James was mostly standing around on offense trying to conserve energy, didn't have the legs to make jump shots late, and got stuffed on the final possession trying to get to the rim. That isn't an indictment of James, who squeezed everything he could out of his team, but it does put some things in perspective. If that's a reality for him at 38, what does 39 or 40 look like? And how much more can the Lakers add to make up for whatever another year takes away from him? That part isn't going to be easy. As of now, the Lakers have James and Anthony Davis on huge salaries, Malik Beasley and Jared Vanderbilt on small salaries, and a whole bunch of question marks about what to do with the rest of the roster. Even if they cleared enough salary cap to sign Kyrie Irving, for instance, what does that get them where James wants to go? Does that get them where James wants to go? Is Davis a reliable enough co-star with his own injury history and the ups and downs we saw from him in the playoffs? These have got to be the questions James will consider in the coming days. Maybe he was merely speaking out of emotion in the wake of a disappointing series, but it seemed pretty clear that he's not going to do this over again just to be out there. So we need to wrap our minds around the idea that James may have played his last game. And even if he does come back, Monday was a stark reminder that the end is probably coming sooner than we previously thought. And some Cape Cod high school sports scores. Born over Martha's Vineyard, 22-7. Softball, Sturgis 12, Rising Tide 0. Cape Tech 19, Atlantis Charter 2, Cape Cod Tech 19, Atlantis Charter 1, which was a doubleheader. Mashpee 15, Nantucket 14. Baseball, Upper Cape 26, Norfolk Aggie 2, Dartmouth 11, Sandwich 3, Cape Cod Tech, Atlantis Charter 1, and Middleborough 13, Falmouth 7. This is Daphne. I've been reading the Cape Cod Times for Thursday, May the 25th, and I hope that today is a wonderful day and that you have a great Memorial Day weekend.